From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Palestinian writer and human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh. He lives in the West Bank town of Ramallah. A few weeks ago, after Israeli tanks rolled into his town, he started a journal of life during the incursion. Then we'll talk with Israeli historian Michael Oren. He's written a history of the Six-Day War of 1967, in which Israel captured, among other territories, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg reflects on the expression moral relativism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal authorities acknowledge they're still not certain what Jose Padilla was planning to do when he arrived in the U.S. last month. Padilla is suspected of plotting to set off a radiation bomb, but officials say they hope to learn more from the suspect himself. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld told reporters today that the first priority of the United States is not to punish Jose Padilla. Rumsfeld says the first priority is to find out what he knows. Padilla's intentions remain unclear. U.S. officials say he traveled to Afghanistan and Pakistan, met al-Qaeda leaders, and received training in radioactive materials and explosives. But it's not clear what target he may have planned to strike, nor do officials know how he might have obtained nuclear material. That's part of the reason that President Bush declared Padilla an enemy combatant and ordered him transferred to military custody. Officials hope he may talk more freely if he's denied a lawyer. But the attorney who represented him in recent weeks has now gone to court, charging that the government is denying an American citizen his rights. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
People who live on the southern edge of Denver, Colorado, are getting ready to evacuate, if necessary, in the face of a wind-driven wildfire that's already spread over 80,000 acres. The fire is now within 35 miles of Denver's outlying suburbs. NPR's Howard Berkus has just returned from the fire line with this description of the blaze.
We were at the very southern tip of this fire, and we saw flames reach massive conifers. The flames would reach the bottom, and then the tree would just explode into flames, burst into flames, 100-foot-tall flames as these trees were hit. They're just so dry that when the fire hits them, they just explode.
NPR's Howard Berkus at Lake George, Colorado. A federal judge has thrown out one of the 9 charges against alleged shoe bomber Richard Reed. Audie Cornish reports from member station WBUR in Boston.
U.S. District Court Judge William Young ruled that the federal terrorism charge of attempting to wreck a mass transportation vehicle doesn't apply to Richard Reed because the term vehicle refers to land travel. The judge also decided that Reed's behavior didn't fall under the scope of conduct defined in the anti-terror law. Prosecutors say Reed attempted to bring down an American Airlines jetliner last December with explosives hidden in his sneakers. Reed and his lawyers are also asking the court to suppress statements he made at the time of his arrest because he was under the influence of sedatives administered during a struggle with the passengers and crew of the flight. Reed is still facing 8 other charges. His trial is scheduled for November. For NPR News, I'm Audie Cornish in Boston.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 128 points, or 1.3%, to close at 9,517. The NASDAQ lost 33 points to close at 1,497. This is NPR News. A Florida jury has awarded $37.5 million in damages to a former smoker who's dying from cancer. The award goes to John Lukacs, a Miami lawyer who lost his tongue to oral cancer and also suffers from cancer of the bladder. The 76-year-old man said his cancer stemmed from 30 years of smoking. The jury ordered 3 tobacco companies, Philip Morris, Brown & Williamson, and the Liggett Group, to pay the award. The companies say they'll appeal. The makers of the anemia drug Procrit are warning doctors, pharmacists, and patients that counterfeit versions of the drug have been found on pharmacists' shelves. NPR's Joe Neal has more.
Procrit is used to treat anemia associated with chemotherapy, AIDS, or surgery. The drug's maker, Ortho Biotech, said several thousand counterfeit vials labeled as Procrit were found in Texas. Each contained a clear liquid and a small amount of Procrit. Further tests showed it was 20 times less potent than the label indicated. Orthobiotech says counterfeiters may be acquiring low-dose vials of Procrit and putting fake labels on them. That means patients may not be getting enough drug. The company says other potential risks can't be ruled out, though it has received no reports of harm. Joe Neal, NPR News.
The Roman Catholic Bishop of Lexington, Kentucky, has resigned amid allegations that he sexually abused three young men. Bishop Kendrick Williams denied the allegations, but said he was stepping down so that the controversy would not leave his diocese without a leader. Williams has been on voluntary leave until the accusations have been investigated. The Vatican said the Pope has accepted the 65-year-old bishop's resignation. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Gund Foundation and Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Later in the show, we're going to hear an interview with Israeli historian Michael Oren, who has written a new history of the Six-Day War, the war in which Israel captured the West Bank and Gaza, as well as other territories. First, we're going to hear from a Palestinian writer and human rights lawyer who lives in the West Bank in the town of Ramallah. Raja Shahadeh is the founder of the human rights group Al-Haq. His book Strangers in the House is about coming of age in the occupied territory of the West Bank. In late March, as Israeli tanks rolled into Ramallah, he began keeping a journal of life during the incursion. The incursion was part of the Israeli operation to root out terrorists in response to the suicide bombings. Shahadeh is currently visiting the U.S., where he was invited to participate in a conference held by the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee. I spoke with him yesterday. Welcome back to Fresh Air. Apparently you woke up to surprising news this morning. What happened?
I called my brother and heard from him that they hadn't slept all night because, and I was sorry to hear that also his six-year-old was also awake. His four-year-old slept through it, but the six-year-old woke up, and they heard tanks rolling into Ramallah. And, you know, tanks make very loud noises. So tanks rolled into Ramallah, and then in the very early morning, they heard on the loudspeaker that curfew is imposed, and now Ramallah is once again occupied and under curfew, and arrests are taking place, and the demolitions and sounds. When you're in your house, it's difficult to determine what is exactly happening. You just hear sounds and you don't know what is really taking place, but they're under curfew.
Your wife was at a conference in Egypt when Israeli tanks moved into Ramallah a month ago, and it took a few days, I think, before you were united. Is she with you now in the United States, or is she in Ramallah?
No, she is with me in the United States visiting her family in Quincy, Illinois. In the first instance, she happened to be away. We knew that something was going to happen, but Anthony Zini was still in the area, and naively we thought the Israelis cannot possibly occupy Ramallah while he's going back and forth to Ramallah. So she was invited to a conference, and it was important for her to go academically. So I said, just take the opportunity and go. And then the occupation began, and I knew we made a mistake. I mean, obviously, eventually she'd be able to come back, but being a Palestinian and having endured years and years of family split and long operations of family reunion, which very often never materialize, I was very disturbed. And at the same time, I was alone in the house during this last occupation for 2 weeks. So it was literally like solitary confinement.
During the incursion, you got a phone call from your brother that Israeli soldiers had taken over his house. What did he tell you?
This was the most shocking thing, because I got this phone and he was whispering. And I said, "Why are you whispering?" And he said, "I have Israeli soldiers in the house." I said, "In the house?" He said, "Yes. They came in the morning, broke the kitchen window, opened the door, and I found them inside the house." And he lives in a building, apartment block, and he's on the ground floor. So the soldiers took him, and he acted as a human shield. And they went up to all the families in the building and brought them down. And then they put everybody in my brother Samer's house in three rooms. And then they started searching the apartments. In one apartment, they found shells. And they came down furious. They said, "You were the people who shot at us." And they said, the owners of the apartment said, we didn't shoot at you." They said, "Yes, here's the proof. These are the empty shells." So they said, "Will you just let us show you something if you allow us to go back to our apartment?" They went back to the apartment. The soldiers had been in their apartment in a previous invasion. And they had made a mess. They broke a pot, plant pot, and the floor was full of the soil. And one soldier had written them a little note saying, "Sorry for the mess. I hope we meet in better times." He wrote this in English. And it was on IDF paper. So they told them, "Here is what happened. Soldiers had come to our building. They left this note. They shot the children, found these empty shells in the garden and collected them."
And the Israeli soldiers accepted that as an explanation?
They had to accept it when they saw the note, and they realized it couldn't be forged because it was on IDF paper. But
let me ask you, does that give you any more of a sense of confidence or respect for the Israeli soldiers? One Israeli soldier left this nice note of apology, hoping to meet again in better times. The other Israeli soldiers accepted that these shells were from Israeli soldiers from a previous incursion. I mean, you know,
one clings to moments like these and examples like these to find humanity in the other side. And it has been a process of dehumanization. You know, we started with an entirely different relationship between the occupier and occupied, and it has been deteriorating and deteriorating. And the deterioration then began to speed up because the soldiers who had come just a few weeks ago to the building and left this note had the decency to apologize for the mess, which is a very nice thing to do. Now, the next time the soldiers came, they let the people out and stayed in an empty apartment. The last time, they literally stayed in the apartment of my brother and his family with them. So while they were watching television, the gun was pointed at them.
You describe your own experiences during the occupation as being like under solitary confinement in prison. Describe a little bit about what it was like in your house. How long were you confined to your house?
The confinement continues for the entire occupation, which was about 4 weeks. And we were let out every between 4 to 5 days to do the shopping. And the first two times, Ramallah was not replenished with food, so we couldn't find fresh fruits and vegetables. And everybody was rushing about. And of course, the destruction in the town was quite dramatic because they had used tanks. Tanks were all over the place. They had gone into buildings and so on. And of course, you heard a million stories about what was happening and who was killed and who was and who died a natural death and couldn't be buried. That was another problem. You know, there were people who had corpses, family members who had died, and they could not be buried, and they had to live with them for days. And then we would be put under curfew after a few hours of lifting the curfew. And it was both a painful physical and psychological experience because the entire day and often the entire night you would hear shelling and sounds of bombs exploding, and you wouldn't know what is happening. And of course, they did random searches of many houses, and so you were constantly under threat of being searched, your house being searched. And also, there was a lot of looting, unfortunately, which is a new phenomenon that we hadn't experienced in the past with the Israeli army. And
who was doing the looting? You're saying the army was doing the looting?
The soldiers. Mm-hmm. The soldiers, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, of course, you heard all the explosions taking place, and you heard from people that they were entering offices and taking the hard disks from computers and doing a lot of destruction. And so, of course, you're wondering all the time whether your own business, in our case, our law office, was going to be entered into or not. I have several friends. Actually, Al-Haq, the human rights organization, which I helped establish in 1979, was taken over. Offices of two friends were entirely destroyed. Large number of institutions and clinics and places where there were, you know, data for all kinds of things, including patients' information, you know, were destroyed and information taken. Cultural centers were entered into. So you sat in the house and you wondered, are they going to come into your house? Are they now searching your office and destroying it? In the beginning, of course, I was very worried about my brother. And, you know, the adults sort of manage. It's the problem is the young, and he has a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. And with the soldiers with them day and night, it was a violation of their world that afterwards they continued to have nightmares for a long time.
Did any Israeli soldiers enter your house?
No.
And did any close friends or any members of your family suffer any injuries?
Fortunately, they didn't. And although I have, my uncle is an old man and he's lost his sight a few years ago, and my mother is an old woman, and nobody needed any kind of medical care throughout the period in my family. So I was very fortunate.
When you were confined to your house and the only way you had of getting information was through the telephone or the television when the television was working or radio, I suppose, what was it like for you to watch the story unfold on TV while you had to stay in your house?
I tell you, the first day, which was a Friday, I watched the television all the time. And we have the now the Arab satellites, and they were reporting everything. And in the beginning, the journalists were allowed to have, you know, to move around. So they were reporting everything. It was very, very weird because we were experiencing in real time, and along with all the Arab world, because everybody else was watching. And it was, very strange because it was happening in Ramallah, in my town, but I was seeing it on television. And it was extremely scary, of course, because in one case, for example, we saw the reporter from Nile television, an Egyptian station, and suddenly he was shot. And you realized what was happening. And then suddenly he was on the ground and his the journalist next to him was trying to revive him and trying to call an ambulance and screaming for an ambulance. And all the time the photographer was continuing to photograph. So, I mean, it was nerve-wracking, absolutely nerve-wracking. In a way, I was saved by the fact that the electricity was cut. And so I stopped watching television. And then I realized I cannot go back to watching television all the time. I started watching only twice a day, in the morning and in the evening, and nothing more. And then, in my case, I decided, regardless of everything around me that is happening, I'm going to go on with my work. And I just became fanatic about work.
What kind of work did you do?
Well, I was working on a manuscript editing, a work of fiction that I was doing, and I had the program of when I was going to finish. I finished in time, and then I got an email from the New York Times. They wanted an op-ed, and I started working on that. And then I was working on a diary, and then I was asked for other articles. I was constantly busy with work. And actually worked more than I ever worked because I had all day and all night to work and I was alone in the house, so no distraction. For me, it was a challenge. I wanted to defeat the purpose of the Israelis, which was to dehumanize me, to reduce me, and I decided I will do exactly what they don't want. I will continue to be productive. I will not be a man reduced.
My guest is Raja Shahadeh, a Palestinian writer and human rights lawyer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Raja Shahadeh. He's a Palestinian human rights worker and lawyer. He's an author. His latest book is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. He's also been keeping a journal of what life was like since the recent Israeli incursion into Ramallah, where he lives. As a Palestinian human rights activist, what do you think about when a fellow Palestinian becomes a suicide bomber? What do you think about when a teenage man or woman blows themselves up to kill Israelis?
Well, I think there are several aspects to the problem. There is first the aspect that I've had to struggle with a lot, which is what kind of rage has brought a human being, and usually young human being, to the point that he's willing to give up his life and blow himself up along with people who he has no right to decide should die. You know, very often it's old women, young men, children. I mean, it's haphazard. Who on earth has the right to decide that the lives of a number of people should end at a certain point? That, I mean, it cannot be acceptable. At the same time, the question is what kind of experience has brought him to the point when he is able and willing to do this. Usually, he is in his early 20s and sometimes younger. His experience has been of oppression at every point, no possibility to think of a future. Probably he has seen the army kill or maim or do an action against his family, his friends or something. He has also not had an experience of Israelis as human beings because since the Oslo, the occupied territories have been closed off from Israel, which wasn't the case before. So, and the first suicide bombing took place in 1994. There was none of this before the Oslo, and the Oslo was 1993. So in the past, there was no restriction on movement. Everybody could go in and out. Israelis came, Palestinians went to Israel. And there was an experience of the other as a human being. But somebody who does an operation now of this sort would never have encountered Israelis except as soldiers, except as oppressors. And so he would be full of rage.
Now, you say that you think Israel's motivation in the incursion into Ramallah is to dehumanize Palestinians and prove to them that they have no future in that land. Israel says its motivation is to end terrorism, to tear apart the terrorist infrastructure and stop the suicide bombings. What do you think of that part of Israel's motivation, what Israel says it's about? Do you see the Palestinian suicide bombers as being part of the cause?
No, I don't see it that way, simply because I don't believe for a minute that Israel is really defending itself by these incursions, because it's the fourth largest army, strongest army in the world, fighting in the streets of Ramallah against commercial centers and against houses full of civilians who are unarmed. And I don't believe for a minute that the Israel's fight is really for defending itself, because Israel is not under threat of going away. I mean, we've never heard of a country in recent history being destroyed, and certainly the power such as Israel is not going to be destroyed by a few angry young men who blow themselves up in civilian areas. At the same time, I think that the way to prevent the extremism is by preventing its cause. And to remove the cause, we have to remove the Israeli presence, which has stifled our life and made it impossible. Otherwise, we're not going to finish with this. There's no two ways about it. And we look for countries such as the United States, who has a stake in Israel and a stake in the region. We would hope that sanity would come from a country like the United States, who would I don't know how they can muster the political will to say enough is enough. We have to end this problem. And ending this problem can only be by dividing the country into two states and giving dismantling the settlements and giving the Palestinians their rights. I mean, it's quite simple and straightforward.
Have you had any disappointments in the Arab leadership?
Well, You know, I don't know about Arab leadership because I would speak about Palestinian leadership.
Palestinian leadership, yes.
Yeah, I've had this appointment with the Palestinian leadership, of course, because I don't get the cue from what the Israeli or the U.S. administration is saying about reforms. We, the people in Palestine, have been speaking about reforms for years and years and years. And it's not something that we would want in order to please anybody else. We want it because it's important for our life. I'm a lawyer, and I can say the judiciary under the Palestinian Authority has been in a worse state than ever before. There's no justification why it should be that bad. I also think that if we had a strong leadership able to make policy and implement policy, we would avoid the interference of so many other parties who do not have necessarily our interests. So, yes, I am disappointed with the Palestinian leadership, but I also appreciate that what Israel is putting forward, which is that reform of the Palestinian leadership is a precondition to getting into, is just another obstacle which Israel has put in the past, you know, I mean, they put various obstacles, and this is just another one of them. So I don't buy that. And I see the two things as separate. We need reforms, but we also need negotiations.
You're in the United States for a brief visit to do some speaking, to participate in a convention. Are you anxious to get home, or would you just as soon stay away for a while? And I'm wondering if you ever think about leaving Ramallah, like moving someplace else so that you wouldn't be subjected to this?
I'm very anxious to go back. I'm, of course, anxious to go back and see my house intact and not destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ramallah and Palestine is my place. It's the place where I feel comfortable. It's the land which I like. It's the people I've always lived with. And yes, life has been very difficult in Ramallah. I've been under occupation, lived under occupation for 35 years. It's never been as difficult and as dangerous as it is now, and as frustrating as it is now. But no, I will not leave.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us, and I hope you stay safe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Raja Shahadeh is a Palestinian writer and human rights lawyer. His latest book is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency by James Bamford, and DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Israeli historian Michael Oren discusses his new book, A History of the Six-Day War, in which Israel captured the West Bank and Gaza, as well as other territories. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the expressions moral equivalence, moral relativism, and moral clarity. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier, we spoke with writer and Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh about what his life has been like in the West Bank town of Ramallah since the Israeli incursion. My guest Michael Oren is an Israeli historian who has written a new book about the Six-Day War. In this war, Israel captured, among other territories, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Oren's book is called 6 Days of War, June 1967, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. He's American-born and moved to Israel shortly after the Six-Day War. He has served as director of Israel's Department of Interreligious Affairs in the government of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, and as an advisor to the Israeli delegation to the United Nations. Let's start with how life in Israel has changed in the wake of the suicide bombings.
Well, on one hand, we go about our normal daily activity. We go to restaurants, we go to movie theaters, our kids go to school, and it hasn't curtailed our usual routine. On the other hand, we're always aware of the dangers and we're always weighing the dangers. So if you go to a certain restaurant that has been in the proximity of suicide bombers in the past, you think twice about going there and you're very curious to see what kind of security arrangements they have. Many restaurants in Jerusalem today have security guards, have gates where they can buzz you in. I also have a son who's in the army and I don't necessarily know where he is at any given time. Just this week when there were 13 soldiers killed in a suicide car attack against a bus. For many, many hours of panic, we didn't know where he was, whether he was among these soldiers. So it's a constant source of anxiety and a factor for rapid aging.
How do you feel about his being in the army now?
I feel where he is in the army, I feel good about it. I know that he feels good about it. I know he's not confronted with moral dilemmas, and he feels very strongly about what he's doing. I feel a certain kind of onus in the sense that I moved to Israel. I was raised in the United States. That was my decision. He was raised as an Israeli, so what for me was sort of voluntary and optional is for him obligatory and a national commitment. And there's a certain amount of onus in that.
Do you think that the Israeli incursions into the territories are an effective way of stopping the terrorist infrastructure?
Well, first, I don't think you can stop the terrorist infrastructure. I don't think anybody reasonably thinks that you can stop terror solely through military means. Certainly, the United States government doesn't feel that way in its war against terror. Obviously, the only solution, long-term solution to terror, is a diplomatic political solution, and that the only people who can really stop terror ultimately are the Palestinians themselves. This doesn't mean that military responses to terror cannot contribute to lessening the terrorist phenomena, can reduce the number of suicide bombings, simply make their work difficult for them. I think it's also important for a sovereign state that when its citizens are attacked, when they're injured, the sovereign state responds in some forceful way. Again, the American paradigm is very relevant here. America, in striking back at Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11, wasn't under the illusion that somehow this would kill al-Qaeda, but it was certainly send a message to people who support al-Qaeda in the world that if you are a regime that's going to give shelter to these type of terrorists, then there's a price to pay. And it's very important that Israel also exact a price for terrorist attacks.
There's a counter-argument that goes like this, that Israel's incursions in the occupied territories are creating more suicide bombers because the suicide bombers, it's so both low-tech and freelance. You don't need a big infrastructure. You don't need a lot of long-term planning. So the more angry young people there are amongst the Palestinians, the more potential suicide bombers there are, and Israel has created a lot more angry young people. Your reaction to that argument?
Well, I understand the argument, and there's certainly an element of truth in it. However, it's a situation that we've faced since our creation in 1948. We've experienced terror on almost daily basis. People have a very short historical memory. As an historian, I chronicle terrorist attacks virtually from the day of Israel's creation. And what was going on today, in perhaps its degree, is more intense, but certainly in the number of terrorist attacks. I recently wrote this book on 1967, and in the months before 1967, there were hundreds of terrorist attacks. And if Israel never responded. It has never been proven that that lack of response to terror would somehow reduce the terror. That, on the contrary, that maintaining an element of deterrence has proven effective in reducing the number of terrorist attacks. I stress reducing and not eliminating. In the immediate aftermath of Israel's defensive shield operation, there was a radical fall off in the number of terrorist attacks, and terrorists who have fallen have become prisoners to Israel, have failed in their suicide attacks, have talked about the difficulties, the tactical and logistical difficulties they've had in mounting these attacks since Israel's recent operation. I wish, Terry, we could speak in absolutes, though, saying if Israel retaliated, then the terror would stop. But we are deeply into the area of gray, where things are not necessarily always black and white.
Do you feel you can justify putting an entire population basically under solitary confinement during for the duration of the incursions?
Well, I think we're placed in a position as a society, whereas we may be very uncomfortable with this, and no one likes being in the position of occupier, that we really have no choice. We didn't bring this upon the Palestinians. The Israeli perception is that the Palestinians brought this on themselves, that Israel made an equitable offer to the Palestinians back in 2001 at Camp David and then at Taba. The Palestinians responded with terror, with violence, and this has forced us to clamp down on the Palestinians in a way that nobody really enjoys, but we really have no choice. I served in the Rabin administration in the earlier half of the 1990s, and there was a significant amount of terror then as well. There were several hundred Israelis killed. People forget that during the Rabin period. And that is when Israel began to close off, been put up with Palestinian cities, began to limit the number of workers who came into Israel, who established checkpoints. And it was always a very painful, difficult decision, because we had embarked on what we thought would be a process ultimately of reconciliation between the Israelis and the Palestinian people. It didn't happen. It is unfortunate.
You served in the Israeli army during the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. You've mm-hmm. written about that a little bit, and you say if it came down to a choice between upholding Israel's higher moral standards or returning home to my new wife, which would I pick? When did you have mm-hmm. to make that choice? Talk a little bit about the dilemma that you faced.
Well, Israel faces a dilemma. The Israeli soldier faces a dilemma in going into an Arab town where he knows there are snipers, he knows there are gunmen, and most armies in the world, and I include the United States under that rubric, will send in its bomber force, its B-52 bombers, and level the city. This is why the United States had no major casualties in Kosovo or in Afghanistan. Israel army puts a high
premium. Let me stop you for a second, because I think the United States made a point of trying to not attack civilians in those bombings. Whether they were successful or not, that was the official strategy.
Always, you try to avoid civilian casualties in the United States Army and in the Israeli Army. The question is the degree to which you're willing to risk your own soldiers' lives to protect civilian lives. Mm-hmm. And I do not think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the United States sent in ground forces into Kosovo. Into civilian areas, they preferred to bomb from 35,000 feet. And there were several thousand civilians killed as a result of that. Those civilian deaths, I would imagine, could have been significantly reduced, if the army had gone house to house rather than bombing from the air. This is what Israel chooses to do.
So what was the specific dilemma you faced when you were in the military?
Well, I was often in a Jenin-like situation. I went through many villages in Lebanon, where there were snipers, where snipers were causing casualty to our men. I was often a target of them. And there's a tendency while you're sitting, you know, under a collapsed building with your head down because you can't keep your head up for more than a second, and you're there for hours. You say, well, why don't they call in the Air Force? Why do we have to do this? And at that point, your military education kicks in, and you recall why you have to do that, because this is what we're about. This is what we're about as an army. It's what we're about as a society.
My guest is Israeli historian Michael Oren, author of a new book about the Six-Day War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Oren. He's an Israeli historian. He has lived in Israel for about 25 years. He was born in the United States. And he's the author of the new book, 6 Days of War, June 1967, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Let's talk a little bit about your book. The 67 War is the war in which Israel took over the West Bank and Gaza. Mm. And so a lot of the conflict now dates back to that 67 War. What questions did you set out to answer when you undertook writing this history?
Well, here's a war that was very short, very limited in its geographic scope. And I can think of very few examples in history where such a limited, intense conflict had such profound regional and even global ramifications over the course of now 35 years. We're dealing not just in the Middle East, but throughout the whole world, we're dealing with the outcome of this war, and indeed every major event that has occurred in Arab-Israeli relations since 67, you know, the Yom Kippur War, the War of Attrition, the Lebanon War, the peace process, the whole question of Israeli settlements, the status of Jerusalem, all of that is an outcome of these 6 intense days of fighting. So the question I set out to answer was, how did it happen? How did we get from there to here? I was fortunate because at the time that I started writing, many Western archives that observe what's known as the 30-year rule, after 30 years they begin to declassify formerly top-secret documents, began to release these documents, and I was able to gain access to tens of thousands of these papers, and that significantly changed certainly my interpretation of the war, things I never imagined. It was quite an eye-opener.
Give us an example of one of the documents that changed your interpretation.
Well, for a long time in the history field, there was an assumption that the Arab calls for war against Israel, President Nasser saying he was going to destroy Israel, other Arab leaders saying they were going to throw the Jews into the sea, was really only so much rhetoric, and the Arabs really never had any operational plans. And going through the documents, both Israeli and Arab, I began to come across actual operational plans by the Egyptians to launch a surprise attack against Israel, an air and ground attack, on May 27th, 1967. That's about 9 days before Israel launched its surprise ground and air attack. And then there was the whole story about why this attack didn't take place. It was a complete fluke. It was the Israelis operating on a hunch, telling the Americans that really in the night between the 26th and the 27th, they think that the Egyptians are going to move. The Americans, President Johnson, informed his counterpart in the Kremlin, Kosygin, who in turn sent his ambassador to wake up Nasser in the middle of the night and said, "Don't you dare." And on the basis of that threat, Nasser canceled the operation. Now, had that operation gone off, the Middle East would have looked very different than it would look today.
One of the contested issues about the 1967 war was Israel's strike against the Egyptian army an act of aggression or an act of self-defense? With the documents that you've uncovered, how would you answer that question?
I think the 67 war was largely a case of misperceptions and miscalculations. We know now from Egyptian records that Nasser didn't exactly want to go to war, even in spite of his often bellicose rhetoric. What he wanted to win was a bloodless political victory. On the Israeli side, one was hard-pressed to try to convince Israeli leaders that Nasser's warlike rhetoric was only just that, a rhetoric, and that he didn't mean to do exactly what he said. Moreover, there are Arab armies gathering on all of Israel's border, not just on the Egyptian border, on the Jordanian border, which was Israel's longest and most vulnerable, and then on the Syrian army from the Golan Heights. And then there were Arab contingents arriving from 21 Arab states. So there was a tremendous sense of war frenzy in the Arab world. Israeli leaders were uniform in thinking that if they don't act quickly and act first, that the future survival of the state was indeed in jeopardy.
After the war ended and Israel was left with new territories, including the West Bank and Gaza, was there controversy within Israel about what to do with that land?
We have to recall that what later became known as the Six-Day War was originally conceived by the Israelis as a 48-hour limited operation that really only had two objectives: to eliminate the Egyptian air force in a surprise attack on the ground and to neutralize the first of 3 Egyptian defense lines in Sinai. That's it. No conquering the whole Sinai Peninsula, no taking Gaza, no seizing the West Bank and Jerusalem, no capturing the Golan Heights. How the war got out of control, how it snowballed from that original plan is a compelling story. It represents a big chunk of what my book's about. And it's one of the major questions that I sought to answer. In the aftermath of the war, on June 19th, 1967, less than 10 days after the ceasefire, the Israeli government voted to return all of Sinai and all of the Golan Heights in return for full peace treaties with Egypt and Syria. That offer was effectively rejected by the Arabs when they met at their summit meeting in Khartoum at the beginning of September, where the Arabs voted no peace, no negotiations, no recognition of Israel. So Israel's initiative was stillborn then. One of the major revelations of the book is the secret Israeli plan in the summer of 1967 to canvass Palestinian leaders in the West Bank regarding the possibility of creating an autonomous Palestinian entity that could possibly evolve into an independent Palestinian state. 80 Palestinian notables were interviewed that summer, as I said, secretly, about the possibility, and each of them came back more or less with the same answer. They said, gee, you know, we'd really like to be autonomous. We'd love to be independent someday. But if we make a treaty with Israel at this time, Arab radicals will kill us. We'll get a bullet in the head. So that initiative also withered on the vine and never got anywhere. But it's interesting that 35 years ago, Israel was dealing with questions of Palestinian statehood, Palestinian autonomy and independence, and a great opportunity, I believe, was lost.
Would you argue, after writing this history, that it would have been in the Arab states' best interest to recognize Israel after the Six-Day War in exchange of land for peace?
It's easy to operate in hindsight. The Arab world in 1967 was in many ways a different world than it is today, and there was a different dynamic. I believe that many Arab leaders, King Hussein, for example, and even Nasser at certain times, were genuinely interested in reaching some type of accommodation with Israel. An earlier research that I did was on the secret peace process between Egypt and Israel in the 1950s, between 10 and 15 years before 67. Nasser was secretly writing letters to Israeli leaders and saying, listen, I'd love to make peace with you, but if I do, they're going to chop my head off, so I can't do it. Unfortunately, the dynamics and the environment in the Middle East hadn't changed significantly in 1967, and Arab leaders could not come out publicly and say they wanted peace. That dynamic began to change with Sadat's historic visit to Israel in November of 1977, and that has really opened the way to a peace process, which, though it has had many vicissitudes and many pitfalls, today still remains the only real show in town.
What are some of the ways that you think Israel's victory in the Six-Day War and Israel's occupation of the territories that are conquered changed Israel?
Well, it changed Israel. It changed the entire Middle East. People tend to forget that the Six-Day War was fought by Israel with French arms, not with American arms. And there had not been a strong or close strategic relationship between Israel and the United States before that. Ben-Gurion, the founder of the State of Israel, never once set foot in the White House. Matter of fact, only one Israeli prime minister, the Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, during the war, visited the White House approximately once for 1 hour before 1967. After 1967, the United States began to view Israel as a strategic asset and began to develop a defense relationship with it, and that has become a predominant factor in Middle Eastern politics today. And that really began with 67. It's also the 67 war also brought for the first time brought Palestinian populations in the West Bank, Gaza, and in Israel proper together under one rule, under Israeli rule, and it had a tremendous impact of developing and formulating a Palestinian identity. The war also heralded the end of Arab nationalism and in its purest form, Nasserism, as the predominant political idiom in the Middle East, and opened the door for the development of Islamic ideologies, which today predominate. And it also ended the Arab-Israeli conflict as an interstate conflict, principally a conflict between Israel, Syria, Israel, Jordan, Israel, Egypt, and began the development of an Israeli-Palestinian a conflict. It's not by accident that in 1968, the PLO, which had really been a shadow organization before the war, emerges as a serious force in Arab politics, and that Arafat takes over that organization in 1968. But more the point, it created a division with Israeli society that has widened over years, and that really for the last 30 years, the major issue dividing Israelis has been the future of these territories, almost the distraction of any other issue, our economy, our society, religious, secular relations. And in that way, the impact of 67 was deleterious and was injurious to Israeli society.
Michael Oren, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you for great questions.
Michael Oren is the author of 6 Days of War, June 1967, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Coming up, Jeff Nunberg reflects on the expressions moral equivalence, moral relativism, and moral clarity. This is Fresh Air. Since September 11th, we've been hearing a lot about the need for moral clarity in our foreign policy. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us that the word clarity always makes him a little nervous.
The historian David Green once observed that in political language, the supreme achievement is to make what is partisan and temporary seem universal and timeless. However unconnected the questions on the table seem to be, repealing the estate tax, parity for women's sports programs, the existence of global warming, we want to think we can consult the same basic principles to determine how we ought to think about them. That's what expressions like moral relativism, moral equivalence, and moral clarity are supposed to accomplish. Give the impression that your political positions all follow from a few basic ethical axioms like the theorems of arithmetic. Of course, some people might become a little wary when they see the word moral in the name of a political doctrine. It's like seeing the word natural on a cereal box. That was the trouble with Jerry Falwell's phrase, moral majority. It gave moral a crudely sectarian meaning, where it seemed to come down to a matter of how you spent your Saturday nights and Sunday mornings. But the right has made much more effective use of the word moral in other phrases. Take moral relativism, the favorite epithet for the left's ostensible refusal to recognize absolute standards of right and wrong. It's an elastic phrase. At one point or another, conservatives have charged the left with relativism or situational ethics for countenancing homosexuality, pornography, euthanasia, abortion, affirmative action, and drug use. When it comes to the crunch, in fact, the sense of morality here may not be that different from Falwell's. But talking about moral relativism seems to put the objections on a philosophical rather than a theological plane. Moral equivalence is used with pretty much the same rhetorical intent. One conservative commentator described it as the ultimate affliction of the liberal mind. The phrase was popularized by Gene Kirkpatrick during the Cold War as a way of condemning criticisms of U.S. actions and policies, as in, are you saying we're no better than they are? But since the fall of communism, it's become a catchphrase for denouncing anything that smacks of undue even-handedness, like giving too much coverage to civilian casualties in Afghanistan or referring to a cycle of violence in Israel as if the Palestinians were merely responding to Israeli attacks. Then there's moral clarity. That isn't exactly a new phrase, but it has acquired a specialized meaning in recent years, particularly since September 11th. William Bennett uses it in the title of his new book, Why We Fight, Moral Clarity in the War on Terrorism. Bennett defines moral clarity as the rejection of both moral relativism and moral equivalence in favor of a morally unambiguous foreign policy. When Bush called on Israel to withdraw its troops from the occupied territories, for example, Bennett accused him of wandering from moral clarity, a charge echoed by Paul Gigot and William Crystal. Critics have objected to the doctrine of moral clarity as an oversimplistic approach for a world where states are often forced to dine with the devil, as Michael Elliott puts it in Time magazine. But my own problems with the notion are more pedestrian than that. Like most expressions that contain the word clarity, this one gets a little cloudy when you hold it up to the light. It's hard to see how you can reject moral equivalence at the same time you're rejecting moral relativism, since those notions are actually at odds with one another. The point comes up quite frequently in my household. "Dad," my daughter complains, "how come I have to clean up my room when your desk is always a mess?" I tell her that that sounds suspiciously like moral equivalence to me. You can't compare my delinquencies with hers. It's really no different from the way I might argue that civilian casualties caused by American bombs in Afghanistan aren't comparable to the deaths caused by terrorists. But in either case, when I reject moral equivalence, I wind up embracing moral relativism or situational ethics. The same acts can be acceptable in one context and unacceptable in another. Not that I'm a dogmatist. There are times when I find it convenient to reject moral relativism in favor of moral equivalence, a position I usually articulate as, "We don't have different rules for kids and grown-ups in this house." Sophie always responds with the obvious objection, but her heart isn't in it. She's learned that broad moral principles are made to be applied in situationally flexible ways. People are willing to embrace moral relativism when it comes to excusing toxic dumping in Africa or working conditions in Indonesia, then wind up taking a firm stand against that doctrine when they're arguing in favor of applying the three strikes law to somebody who breaks into a garage to steal a bicycle. Crime is crime. Is that an inconsistency? Not really, unless you're pretending that the complexities of moral judgment can be reduced to categorical rules of thumb. That's what drives people to come up with distinct phrases to fuzz over the inconsistencies. When you do it, it's moral relativism. When I do it, it's the repudiation of moral equivalence. Left or right, political rhetoric has always had the job of concealing internal contradictions. And for those purposes, few words are better suited than clarity. Even after Nixon made a national joke out of "Let me make one thing perfectly clear," clarity is still out there throwing up smoke. As the French poet Henri Méchanique once said, "Clarity, was there ever a notion more obscure?"
Jeff Nunberg is a researcher at Stanford's Center for the Study of Language and Information, and he's the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Chirac. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of American Chica, Two Worlds, One Childhood by Maria Rana, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, balancing personal liberty with increased national security, we talk with Locke Johnson, an expert on U.S. intelligence. Also, we meet a Navajo code talker who served in the South Pacific in World War II. The Navajo code talkers are the subject of the new John Woo movie, Wind Talkers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.